How was this morning?
Very good. I mean, not a lot of people, but it's not embarrassing. Okay, I'd like to welcome everyone. We're really honored and delighted to have with us Uriel Heilman, who will be guiding us through a very controversial issue, the battle for Beit Shemesh, and the implications of that battle between zealots and Zionists, the implications of that battle really for the soul of Judaism. That's our title. This is an issue that it's happening in Eretz Israel, but it's close to us in many ways. We have former members of our shul that live in Beit Shemesh. Many of us have relatives that live in Beit Shemesh. And it's not just Beit Shemesh. What's happening in Beit Shemesh is emblematic, really, of a cultural battle that's going on in Eretz Israel today and really in Judaism today. So we're very honored to have Uriel Heilman here, and I'd like to introduce Rabbi Clapper, the Center for Modern Torah Leadership, who will introduce Uriel.
This is, this year is sort of the fulfillment of a life stream to get to be head of an organization that has people who introduce people to introduce people. We go mechayel el chayel, perhaps in a few years we'll have people to introduce the people who introduce the people who introduce the people. Welcome to the second in the 2012 dialogue series of public conversations with the Center for Modern Torah Leadership. I want to especially begin this, not usually we end, but I want to begin by thanking Ann Sender, who really put this whole evening together with very little assistance from me. So thank you very, very much for doing that. I'm very pleased to introduce tonight Uriel Heilman, who is the managing editor of the Jewish Telegraphic Agency. If you don't know about that, you should please look it up. It's a Jewish wire service and provides much of the news that shows up in local Jewish newspapers, really worth looking into. Uriel is also an old friend of mine, going back to my days as the Orthodox advisor at Brandeis, I believe, long, long time ago when I was young. And I thought of bringing him in tonight specifically because as I began, as we all, you know, began looking into trying to figure out what on earth is going on to Beit Shemesh, the report that he wrote was for me a window into the complexity of the situation as opposed to presenting it as a straightforward story of good and evil, and knowing where the right and wrong is and who all the actors are. This past Tuesday night, we were privileged to hear Rabbi Yehuda Gilad, and part of what we emerged in that conversation is the complexity of the Israeli religious situation and how many different sides there are in terms of what constitutes Judaism in the state of Israel, even though it doesn't have the denominational complexity of the United States that you have. In addition, you have splits within the quote-unquote Haredi community between the Litvaks and the Misnagdim and the Hasidim. What exactly is the place of the Eid Haredis within the Haredi community? How do each of these relate to what's called the Chardal, the Haredi Lumi community? What's the role of the religious Zionist community, but the non-Chardal religious Zionist community referenced the what used to be called the mainstream Dati Lumi community, but may no longer be the mainstream. And how do all of these relate to the community sort known as Chilonim, which itself divides into Ashkenazim and Sephardim in many other ways? I think that that we've all seen, as Rabbi Sender noted that the situation in Beit Shemesh is not the only situation going on right now which involves the relations between the gender and the public role of women, and yet the communities involved in the battles over these are very different. That one has simultaneously a battle of this sort in Beit Shemesh, where we'll see what Uriel has to say. It seems that the primary actors are anti-Zionists and in the army, and yet that somehow these are seen as they are going on simultaneously presents them as part of a unified phenomenon. It's a fascinating thing. So I'm looking forward very much to Uriel's presentation. I hope that we'll emerge with a real sense of what actually is going on, what the facts on the ground are, and how We understand them. I'm looking after Ariel's presentation, which we estimate is about half an hour. I may have a few follow-up questions, and then we'll throw it up to the audience, and I look forward to a really stimulating conversation. And with that, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rabbi Clapper, for the introduction, and thanks for coming out. It's nice to see some familiar faces in the audience. It's nice to be back in Sharon. You know, many of you will remember in the early days of the Second Intifada, there was this joke going around Israel. At the time, there was great concern about the security situation, and there were a lot of cancellations of visits. Hotels were suffering, the airlines were suffering, and I remember at the time, and many of you probably heard this story, Israelis were downplaying a lot of those fears. They said, look, you know, you hear these this terrible things on the news, but it's really overblown. It's not all of Israel that's dangerous, it's just certain parts that are dangerous. If you avoid Jerusalem, you'll be just fine. And even in Jerusalem, it's not really a problem, it's just a couple of specific neighborhoods, for example, like Gilo, which is right on the eastern edge of the city, opposite Beit Jala, where there's a lot of shelling. And even in Gilo, it's not such a problem, because most of Gilo is on the side of the hill where you can't really see Beit Jala. It's really just one or two streets that kind of face the Arab, the Palestinian neighborhood. And even on those streets, once they built the wall, it wasn't so much of a problem because the wall blocked most of the apartment buildings. It was just toward the end in this one apartment building. And even there, I have to tell you, it wasn't the whole building because the bottom story was under where the wall would be, so the projectiles couldn't hit it. It was just in this one apartment on the second floor that was really a problem. And I have to tell you, even in that apartment, you know, the bedrooms were all in the back. So no problem with the bedrooms. It was really just the kitchen that was exposed. And I have to tell you, even in the kitchen, you know, if you sat at the table, no problem whatsoever, because that wasn't near the window. It was more the fridge area that was a problem. And, you know, if you were going to get something from the fridge, in the refrigerated area, it's not such a problem because that's down low. It was really the freezer area that was a problem. But do not go near that freezer. That's an incredibly dangerous place. And I was thinking about this story a lot in the last few weeks when I was hearing about Beit Shemesh, because we were hearing the same kind of thing about Beit Shemesh. And like the Gilo situation, it was half serious, or more than half serious. You know, Beit Shemesh has become a flashpoint for Haredi, non-Haredi tensions in Israel. But generally speaking, Haredim and non-Haredim in Israel seem to get along. Just a few miles away from Beit Shemesh, if you go to Tel Aviv, the Tel Aviv area, the largest concentration of Israelis in the country, you go from secular Tel Aviv and you drive on Jabotinsky Street right through ultra-Orthodox Haredi Bnei Brak and onto modern Orthodox Petach Tikva, and everybody seems to live in their own little communities and people get along and there are no great fights. It's just that there's this one flashpoint. But just like the shelling of Gilo had implications for all of Israel, and everybody had a stake in that battle, so too with Beit Shemesh, it's a front line of a battle for the soul of Israel and for religious pluralism in the country. And I have to tell you that this is not the first time that we're seeing a battle. This has really captured headlines and been a big item in the news, and of course we're talking about the attacks around this this all-girls elementary school called Banot Orot in a particular neighborhood of Beit Shemesh. But this is hardly the first time that there have been problems in Beit Shemesh and even in Israel generally between Haredim and non-Haredim. Many of you will remember about a decade ago the flashpoint was the closing of Kvish Bar Ilan in Jerusalem on Shabbat, a major thoroughfare that passed by a Haredi neighborhood. There were on-again, off-again protests involving throwing of rocks, throwing of garbage, and eventually a compromise was reached. More recently, 2 years ago, it was the opening of a parking lot called Karta outside the Jaffa Gate, right outside the old city in Jerusalem, under a new pedestrian mall. The parking lot was open on Shabbat, and there too you saw an influx of Haredi protesters on Shabbat throwing dirty diapers, which they have in great supply for some reason, verbally and physically harassing people, including police. In the last few months, one of the great issues of debate in Israel has been these gender-segregated buses. People are very upset about some of these buses are quote-unquote voluntarily segregated. The Supreme Court issued a ruling a while back that gender-segregated buses are illegal. Nevertheless, they persist. Even smaller flashpoints that we don't hear about as much, such as when Haredi community members are placed under arrest for various reasons. There was a story a few months ago about a woman in Jerusalem who was put under arrest for starving her child. She was a mentally unstable woman. They arrested her and took her kids into custody or put them in protective custody, and the response was Haredi rioting. Now, most of these cases have been in Jerusalem, but some of them have also been in Beit Shemesh. And there's a reason that Beit Shemesh and Jerusalem stand out, and they really differ from the rest of Israel. And I'm going to talk a little bit about why. Let's talk for a moment about Beit Shemesh. Just a little bit of historical context for those who may not know. Beit Shemesh, just a half hour outside of Jerusalem, about midway between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, was founded in the early years of the state, really as an unofficial development town with a predominantly Moroccan population. And it stayed as a pretty simple, unnoticed place for many decades, until about 20 years ago, when there was an influx of Russian-speaking immigrants to the city, part of a wave of 1 million immigrants from the former Soviet Union that came to Israel on Aliyah. And in the ensuing years, there were some Ethiopians who were moved in. They too were Olim, the so-called Falashmura. And in the last decade and a half or so, primarily because developers started building these developments on the edge of Beit Shemesh, Ramat Beit Shemesh, Ramat Beit Shemesh Aleph, Bet, Gimel, you've of course heard of these. Some of you have family there, I'm sure. There was an influx both of a lot of overseas immigrants, Americans, British, Australians, other Anglo immigrants who moved to Israel, very popular area, and of course Haredim, who decamped from Jerusalem in search of cheaper housing. So really you had a city that had been pretty ethnically monolithic, become very heterogeneous in a relatively short amount of time, growing very quickly. Now it has a population of estimated 70,000 to 80,000 people. And the mayor of Beit Shemesh a few years ago, before the current mayor, his name is Daniel Vaknin, his strategy to stay in power was to kind of keep all these ethnic groups at bay and play them against each other. And he decided to build this modern Orthodox school right at the edge of a Haredi community in Beit Shemesh. And not just any Haredi community, but a community of Haredim who happen to be among the most extreme fundamentalist Haredim that there are in Israel. And he put this school right there to kind of check their growth. And this was a thorn in their side. There were protests at the time when the school was built, but the school was built nonetheless. And when it opened this past September, hell, so to speak, broke loose. But even before this September, Beit Shemesh had been a flashpoint, particularly because these Haredim who came from Jerusalem and moved to the neighborhood were among the more extreme Haredim, and I'm going to get into more detail about who they are in a minute. A few years ago, there was a pizza store owner who had to close up his pizza shop because of threats and harassment from the Haredim, because he had allowed boys and girls to sit together, and because he took down a sign demanding that only those with modest dress come and eat. In 2007, a woman and an Israeli soldier were attacked on a bus because they refused to move to the back. There was a mall that was under construction that was stopped because Haredim demanded that the mall maintain separate shopping hours for men and women. And in 2009, there were attacks against a group of modern Orthodox teenage girls on a Friday night who were, so to speak, dressed immodestly. And many of us have seen pictures of a woman walking around Beit Shemesh. Well, I say woman, we could only surmise that she's a woman because she's completely covered in head to toe in a burqa, which is one of those, it's basically an Islamic dress. And she was convicted in 2009 for beating many of her 12 children. So this is hardly the first time that there has been an incident of Haredi extremism in Beit Shemesh. But what happened this time that captured, I think, the attention of the world was simply the fact that this was well covered by an Israeli TV program. The protests against the school, which had been ongoing for many years during the construction, It reached a fevered pitch in September when the school finally opened. This is an elementary school for girls called Banot Orot. And we, JTA, my news service, we wrote about it in September when the protest started. And at the time, there were it was already clear to people they were calling. I mean, I don't want to repeat a lot of what was said because it's so repugnant. But they were calling little girls prostitutes and sluts and other terrible things, spitting on them, throwing them. But what really galvanized Israeli public opinion was when, at the end of December, Israel's Channel 2 broadcast a report about this 8-year-old girl whose parents were American. Her name was Naama Margolies. And she talked about how she was afraid to walk to school. The family only lived a few blocks away, but this little girl was frightened. And it's for a moment, it seemed like all of Israel was focused on Beit Shemesh. And it wasn't just Israel. There were headlines in the New York Times, I'm sure in the Boston Globe, and really all over the world. Israeli politicians weighed in. Israel's opposition leader, Tzipi Livni, went to a protest in Beit Shemesh against the violence. There were clashes between police and Haredim in Beit Shemesh. And of course, there was a counter-protest in Jerusalem of Haredim wearing concentration camp garb. These are all things that I assume most of you know, and this is part of why you've come out to hear me tonight, also probably to argue with me. And for observant Jews, I think this was particularly disturbing and particularly painful to behold. Because we've seen these attacks in the past, attacks on immodestly dressed women, Jerusalem bus stops that have been defaced because they have a bikini-clad woman, other attacks of Haredim on secular life. And we know that that secular life, to a large extent, is anathema to most, if not all, Haredim. But here was a case where you had Haredim attacking a modern Orthodox girl going to an all-girls school. And it just boggled the mind to some extent. And it pained us because we see ourselves bound by the same Torah. And when something like this happens, we ask, how can a God-fearing Jew behave this way? And I think it really upset us to our kishkas. And what I set out to find out, and Rabbi Klapper made reference to the story that I write, was how could Haredim, who also are Torah-fearing Jews, countenance this behavior? Because clearly the vast majority of Haredim were not participating in this repugnant behavior. They were not attacking the girls. They were not dressing up in concentration camp uniforms. And what I want to talk tonight a little bit about was how the Haredim feel about this, what it means for Haredim and Haredi Judaism, and what it may mean for the future of Israel. One of the few Haredi organizations to respond was the Agudath Israel of America, which is the umbrella group of Haredi Jews in America. And I want to read to you a small section from that press release. They wrote, "Those who have taken pains to note that the small group of misguided individuals who've engaged in this conduct are not representative of the larger Haredi community are to be commended. It is disturbing, though, that some Israeli politicians and secularists have been less responsible, portraying the actions of a very few as indicative of the feelings of many. Quite the contrary, the extremist element is odious to and rejected by the vast majority of Haredi Jews." But if so, where were the rest of the Haredim? Why weren't they speaking out? Where were their voices? In truth, there is a spectrum of viewpoints in the Haredi community that is just as wide as the spectrum of viewpoints in the modern Orthodox community and just as wide as the spectrum of viewpoints in the Jewish community at large. We often see things in black and white, but in truth, there are many shades of gray among the Haredim, even if they all do wear black and white. You know, among the divisions between the Haredim are divisions between Ashkenazi and Sephardi, between Hasidish and Yeshivish, what we used to call Misnagdish, between moderates and extremists. And then there are the subgroups. Within the Hasidic community, there's Belz, there's Ger, there's Toldos Aaron, there's Satmar. There are extremist groups like Geturei Karta, which is an offshoot of Satmar. And even within the Hasidic sects, there are divisions. There are the Satmar of Brooklyn. There are the Satmar of Kiryas Yoel in upstate New York. There are a few Satmar in Israel. And some, even within Hasidic sects, there are sometimes competing rebbes. And some, of course, which have no rebbe at all. And just like we can tell the difference between, in the modern Orthodox community, between somebody who might wear a knit yarmulke, a kippah sulga, or a black velvet, or somebody who wears a blue shirt to shul on Shabbos versus somebody who only wears white shirts to shul, or dark suits versus those who wear brown suits. This, of course, says nothing about me. This just happens to be what I'm wearing. The Haredim, too, are distinguishable, sometimes by these little hints. There's those who wear suits and those who wear kapata coats, those who wear fedoras and those who wear fur hats. There's the height of the fur hat, which may identify what sect you wear. There are those who wear the dark kapata versus striped ones. This is something you don't really see in America, but in Israel, particularly in Jerusalem, you see some people wear gold robes, gold and blue stripes. These are all signifiers of the sect from which they come. Among the women, there are those who wear wigs. There are those who only wear kerchiefs. There are those who wear kerchiefs over wigs. There are those who wear kerchiefs over their hair. And there are those who shave their heads and wear kerchiefs. There is no single Haredi community. It is a falsehood. It is just as false as saying there's a single Jewish community. And what we're seeing in Beit Shemesh, and what we've seen in these other protests and these other incidents of violence, is really an extremist fringe. These are hooligans. Every community has its hooligans, and these are the hooligans of the Haredi community. By the way, if you look at these protesters, they're not middle-aged, pot-bellied Haredim with lots of kids. These are people in their teens and in their 20s, thugs. Like the thugs that you might see outside the protests against the World Bank or the World Trade Organization. But make no mistake about it, they're not the only ones who believe in the efficacy of violence to enforce what they see as religious mores in a culture war against creeping secularism. On the extreme end, these hooligans are the Sikrikim. This is a name that they've taken for themselves that harkens back to the Latin word sicari, a group of Jewish zealots who attacked the Romans and Jews during the Roman conquest of Judea. And this is hardly the first time in the history of the state of Israel in which Haredim have used violence. Back in the 20s and 30s, there was lots of Haredi violence against secularists in the emerging state, before there was a state, from everything against the formation of soccer clubs that played on Shabbat, to attacks against Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, who was dismembered in effigy, denounced as a Christian missionary, and doused with buckets of water. And these aren't just the people who are seeing today are not just the ideological descendants of these early violent Haredim from the 20s and 30s, but in some cases they are the actual descendants. In the Haredi neighborhood near Beit Shemesh, there's a shul run by a guy named Rabbi Meir Heller. His great-grandfather was one of the leaders of the violence in the 20s and 30s. And his shul has a kollel run by a guy named Lubetsky, whose father-in-law, Moshe Hirsch, is an Iture Karta. These are people who are violently anti-Zionist. Rabbi Moshe Hirsch served as a minister in Yasser Arafat's Palestinian Authority. Just so we know who these people are. And many of the current troublemakers are linked to Iture Karta. You will hear many Haredim who say it's the same 100 or 200 people at all these protests. And to some extent, there's truth to that. But they also represent a much larger group who believe in this culture war and even believe in the efficacy of violence, but may not be willing to use it. And in that sense, the Sikrikim are not so much aberrations, but products of a much wider milieu, who believe that the state of Israel is bad for the Jews, some might even say evil, and they're fighting a culture war. And the group that really births these Sikrikim is the Eda Haredis, or we would call it Eda Haredit, but none of them call that. It's all the Eda Haredis. And this is really the concentration of the most extreme Haredim. They're aligned with Satmar, and they may not use violence themselves, but they believe violence is necessary. A lot of them often use a metaphor of a cat and a mouse. If you have an infestation of mice, you're going to need a cat. You may not want to be the cat. You may not want to own the cat, but you need cats if you're going to put down the infestation of the mice. And of course, in this metaphor, the mice is the creeping secularism or even modern Orthodox girls. And the Haredim and Jewish society is hardly the only one in which we see this. We also see this in Muslim societies, in Christian societies. You know, it's not that the group of Muslims who are perpetrating attacks around the world, it's a very small group of Islamists and representing a very small group of the Muslim religion. But there's a much wider proportion of Muslims who support such attacks, even if they may not perpetrate themselves. There's a spectrum. There's one fundamental difference, though, about the Haredim, which is that the Haredim and Haredi violence is not meant to cause serious injury or death. You'll be hard-pressed to find a single incident, certainly in the last few years, where anybody's been seriously injured or anybody has been killed. There was this incident in the news a couple weeks ago about this woman in Beit Shemesh who said she was attacked by Haredim. Her car was defaced, bleached, the windows were punched out, the tires were punctured, and she said that she feared for her life. But I think that was more her fears than the intent of her attackers. These are not people who mean to kill. One question that we have faced in looking at this situation is, why is there so much more violence and extremism in Israel than there is in America? And I think there are a few reasons for this. One is that in America, there's a recognition by the Haredim that this is not, we don't run the show. Even though they may run the show in their little communities, in their little neighborhoods, they don't run the show. There's a larger environment in which they live, and that has a moderating influence. But in Israel, that's not the case at all. The Haredim feel like this is, they're the landlords. They can do whatever they want. And in fact, as their numbers grow larger and larger, the Haredi population of Israel is now 1/7 to 1/6 of the entire Jewish population as a whole. They grow even more emboldened. There's also the influence of Middle Eastern extremism. They live in a region where there's a lot of extremism. That's not the case in America. And as they grow, they are exercising their political clout. Finally, there are those Haredim who believe in this culture war against secularism, but believe that violence is not the answer. And I believe this comprises most Haredim. Most Haredim don't believe in the violence, but they just keep to themselves. And then there are even a few Haredim who try to fight the violence through positive means. For example, try to fight the culture war through positive means. Chabad, for example, is fighting a culture war. They want to increase religious observance. It's no coincidence that they call their outreach vehicles mitzvah tanks. They are tanks. And Tzivas Hashem, their youth organization, is the army of God. It is a war. But it's a war that they're trying to fight through more positive means, getting people to shake a lulav or light a Hanukkah menorah or something like that. So, and let's also not pretend that this extremism is something that our own community is immune to. Mayor Kahana and the Jewish Defense League was spawned by the modern Orthodox community. And if you think about the way the community reacted to Kahanist extremism, there was also a spectrum. There were those who joined Common Cause with him and went out to fight the fight. There were those who believed that it ought to be fought but didn't want to participate themselves. There were those who didn't like it but they didn't condemn it. And then there were those who condemned it. And even the most memorable extremist in the history of Israel came not from the Haredi community, but from the modern Orthodox community, Yigal Amir, who assassinated Yitzhak Rabin. And how many of modern Orthodox Israelis heard anti-Rabin rhetoric and extremist rhetoric in the years and in the months leading up to the assassination and did nothing about it or perpetuated it? So let's not pretend that it's a problem only of the Haredi community. We all have this problem. Now, if there are Haredim who oppose this, why are we not hearing their voices? Where are their voices in opposition? And again, there are a few reasons for this. There are a few answers. Some don't have the courage to speak out because they don't want to be seen as religiously lax. They live in communities in which to speak out is to put yourself at risk. A few years ago, when Rabbi David Cohn, the leader of the Toldos Aron Hasidim, spoke out against some of the violence in the Dvar Torah about Parshas Pinchas, talking about how zealotry is not always good, he was condemned very quickly in placards posted around Mea Shearim, what the Haredim call Pashkivilim. And he was from among the more conservative Haredi groups. Then there are those who believe that the secular media and secular people are out to demonize all Haredim. So why bother to speak out against your own kind? And there's some truth to this. If you listen to the rhetoric in Israel, not just among the secular, but even among the modern Orthodox, in response to what's happening in Beit Shemesh and elsewhere, people always talk about the Haredim, the Haredim. They don't say the Haredi hooligans, the Haredi zealots, the Haredi extremists. They say the Haredim. So why would a Haredi want to put his neck out on the line to castigate his own kind? Likewise, many just don't see it as their community. Why should a Haredi who's told us Aaron in Jerusalem condemn what's happening in the Turei Karta and Beit Shemesh? It doesn't involve him. And these are people who, they generally don't get involved in things that don't affect them, their own community. It would be like asking the white Caucasians who live in Connecticut to condemn what the KKK is doing in Kentucky. It's just not relevant to them. And there are those who see it as so obvious that they don't support the violence that they don't even think it merits mentioning. Again, like the example of Connecticut and the KKK, it's not relevant to them. And to some extent, this is difficult for us to understand because this is the opposite of what Jewish organizations do. I have to tell you, as the managing editor of JTA, I get oodles and oodles of emails every day with press releases from Jewish groups. They will issue a press release on everything, from the bombing of churches in Nigeria, I got from four different Jewish organizations 2 weeks ago, I don't know why, to condemnations of suicide bombings in Israel, which I think is the most ridiculous thing, because I don't need the American Jewish Committee to tell me that they're against bombings of Jews in Jerusalem. It's kind of obvious, don't you think? But even when the Haredim do condemn things, we're unlikely to hear them. Why is this? They're not delivered in the same way as they are in the non-Haredi world. I don't get emails from the Belzer Rebbe. I just don't get it. Maybe he doesn't have my email address, but for some reason I just don't think he's on emails. And he's not on Facebook or Twitter either. In the Haredi world, the condemnations are generally directed inward, not outward. They're generally not delivered in press releases, but in Divrei Torah. They're generally not delivered in English. They're not even delivered in Hebrew. They're delivered in Yiddish. And they're generally not delivered as a reaction to current events, but rather more obliquely as a Dvar Torah and a way to call for dignified behavior by Torah-observant Jews. Let me give you one example. One of the few Haredim who did condemn what was happening in Beit Shemesh while the firestorm was going on was the Belzer Rebbe, who has an estimated 45,000 followers worldwide. He's based in Jerusalem. His name is Rabbi Yisachar Dov Rokach. And I'm going to quote you something that he said. This was essentially his condemnation of what was happening in Beit Shemesh. This was delivered on a Motzei Shabbos in his Beis Medrash with thousands of people there, but it's delivered in Yiddish as a Dvar Torah. But as a sign, and this is unusual, of the intent to project this to the outside world, he invited Gideon Sar, Israel's education minister, to be with him on that night. It was the fifth night of Hanukkah, and he was lighting the Chanukiah, and this was his little vort. He said, "If there are those in our generation who believe that warfare is the way to spread the light of Judaism, they are mistaken." And this was actually picked up by Israel Radio. I don't know if Gideon Sar, the education minister, picked it up because it was said in Yiddish. And it's not something that made it into much of the general press in Israel. But this was how the condemnation was delivered. But of course, there are a few exceptions to this rule. For example, Rabbi Avadia Yosef, the spiritual leader of Shas, who does issue press releases, and his statements are widely covered by the press. But bear in mind, this is the same person who said that Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans because the people who live there are not God-fearing people and they deserve that punishment. So take it for what it's worth. And then there are a few Haredim who have been vocally opposing what's happening, a small, very small but growing minority. One example is a newly established party in Beit Shemesh called the Tov Party, It's a party of moderate Haredim. And they went out to this demonstration that took place a few nights after that TV report about the 8-year-old girl getting spit on. And they went out to the demonstration and they participated. But it was difficult for them because at the same demonstration there were people carrying placards that were anti-Haredi. So it's very difficult for the Haredim to join the secularists or the modern Orthodox or the non-Haredi world and protest against their own kind, especially in the society in which they come from. Now, in the weeks since the Beit Shemesh brouhaha, there's been a small but growing chorus of Haredi voices who have chimed in against the violence. But still, they're few and far between. Now, sitting here in the United States, this is happening very far away. For many of us, it's close to our hearts, it's close to our family. But ultimately, why should we care about this? And I think it's because it's about what kind of society we want Israel to be. There's the growing Haredi population in Israel makes this question all the more urgent. And this is not the only question, the question of religious pluralism, extremism, etc. There's a major economic component to Haredi growth. Most Haredim don't enter the workforce until they're in their 30s. This is creating a massive problem of poverty among Haredim, and it's a drain on the resources of the state. There are some Haredim who are anti-Zionist and refuse to take welfare from Israel, but most of them do take welfare, and it's a big drain. And once they do enter the workforce, they generally don't enter professions in which they make a lot of money. And it's a problem for the Haredi community most of all, but it's a problem really for all of Israel. There's the issue of the army. Haredim don't serve in the army. This generates a lot of resentment in Israel. There's a vociferous debate in the Knesset 2 weeks ago about the extension of the Tal law, a law which grants exemptions to Haredim who study in yeshiva rather than going to the army. So there's a lot going on with Haredi growth in Israel. And there are various ways that Israel's trying to deal with this. There are new workforce training programs to help Haredim learn trades. There are programs like Nachal Haredi to integrate Haredim into the army, and that program has grown significantly in recent years, though it still represents a tiny, tiny portion of Haredim. And, you know, Haredim do participate in Israeli political life, of course. There are growing Haredi parties, and in fact, growing Haredi political clout, not just on the national level, but also on the local level. For example, the mayor, the current mayor of Beit Shemesh is a Haredi. His name is Moshe Abutbul, and he's come under a lot of criticism for his handling or mishandling or lack of handling of the problem around the school. But I think the real question for Judaism in Israel is the question of pluralism. You know, the Haredim still control the issues of marriage, divorce, burial, kashrut, and they really have a stranglehold, a monopoly on these issues, and that's been a great problem for a lot of Israelis. And it affects us here, too. I think, first of all, it's a chilul Hashem when we see what's happening in Beit Shemesh. Hillary Clinton, a couple of weeks after this incident in Beit Shemesh, talked about how Israel is a place where the forces of religious fundamentalism threaten religious liberty. Last week, I don't know if you heard, the U.S. State Department issued a travel advisory for Jerusalem, warning that people who dress in certain ways, go to certain neighborhoods, could come under physical attack. A travel advisory. But perhaps most importantly, it's a turnoff for us to be Jews. It's a turnoff for our kids. When you preach Torah observance, and then you see these people who are seen as paragons of Torah observance behaving in such repugnant ways. And it's not just the secular or the liberal streams of Judaism that are the targets, but it's the modern Orthodox community that are the targets too. The attacks in Beit Shemesh were on a modern Orthodox girls' school. And the Haredi-controlled rabbinate has invalidated conversions that were performed in the United States by modern Orthodox rabbis. This is not just a war against secularism. This is a war against anything that's non-Haredi. There's some debate in Israel about the significance and the causes of Haredi violence. Is it a reflection of the extremist nature of the Middle East? Is this why today you might see a woman wearing a burqa, and in another generation we might see an extremist suicide bomber? Is it that Haredim feel that they're winning the culture war and they feel emboldened, or that their growing numbers present them with increasing clout? Or are these acts of desperation by Haredim who see that their way of life is not economically or religiously sustainable? What's clear is that this is not a problem just for the Haredi community, but for Israel as a whole. And I would add that the extremism is not a problem just for the Haredi community, but for Israel as a whole. Israel is a place of extremism. Israel is a place where tolerance does not thrive. We're talking now about the Haredi community, but in the Dati Leumi community, there is a growing stream of extremism in the settlements of people who exact so-called price tag, or in Hebrew, tav mechir, attacks on their Palestinian neighborhoods, neighbors, burning olive trees, defacing gravestones with Magen Davids, like neo-Nazis deface Jewish gravestones with swastikas. And it represents a danger for all of Israel. I think it's time that Israel learned how to live together, and Israelis learned how to live together. If you visit Israel, you'll notice that everybody's compartmentalized. There are communities that are Dati Lumi with TVs. There are communities that are Dati Lumi, but they don't allow TVs. There are Haredi communities like this and Haredi communities like that. And people don't live mixed. They all live in their separate little enclaves. And it's an increasing threat. You know, about 2 weeks after this whole story blew up in Beit Shemesh, I was in Miami Beach, Florida. I had not been there in 30 years, since I was a little kid, and I didn't realize the extent to which it's Haredi. I don't know who among you visit Miami Beach frequently. I had no idea. I went there, and you walk by the pool, and there are people in bathing suits sitting by the pool, and meanwhile there are Haredim who are staying in the same hotel, who have had their doors changed from a key lock to a manual lock for Shabbos. And the Eruv in Miami Beach encompasses even the boardwalk. And you, to get to the boardwalk, you have to pass by the pool. So the Haredim walk by the pool. They're not throwing stones at anybody. Some of them are looking up in the air. Some of them aren't looking so much up in the air. The women, who don't have a prohibition of seeing scantily clad men, are sitting poolside, Haredi women, fully clothed, with their little, you know, one-year-old who's in a bathing suit. And the men are walking up and down the boardwalk. And, you know, on Shabbos you see all these people walking, and there's minyanim. And I was thinking, why can't Israel be a little bit more like Miami Beach? And, you know, it's funny, but it's also, it's true. Israel could have something to learn from the way that there's tolerance in a place like that. And I don't know, maybe there are a lot of Haredim who don't go to Miami Beach because of what goes on there. But there are a lot of Haredim who do live there and who do visit, and everybody seems to get along. So, you know, we should keep going to Israel, and maybe they should come visit Miami Beach. Anyway, thank you for coming. I'm happy to take some questions and open up for discussion. For Rabbi Clapper.
No, that's the first question that I'll turn it over to. Thank you very much. The one I think that I didn't address there is earlier is that there is a series of issues that seem to be along the same axis happening in the army at the same time. And when you talk about Haredi voices and reactions, so you didn't talk about how the Haredi Lumi community has reacted to these things. And in a large measure, a lot of this depends on, I think, the cultural shift in Israel depends on which side the Haredi Lumi community sees itself. In these cultures, I wonder if you could talk about that.
Okay. So when you're talking about the army, I'm guessing that you're talking about an incident where there were soldiers who wanted exemptions from being at a ceremony where a woman was singing.
Yeah.
And the answer was no. I think that their timing was problematic. You know, once this whole Beit Shemesh thing blew up and everybody was so focused on this, the army, and I think Israelis generally, were in no mood to be accommodating of Haredim or of these religious sensibilities. And that wasn't the only case. I know that in the Technion, there were some Haredi Leumi students who asked for separate hours in the gym, separate men and women hours, and they were turned down too. And I think when there's such ferment and it's such a hot issue, people make decisions not on the basis necessarily of what's fair or not, but what just of emotion. And there is a lot of emotion in Israel on this issue. I mean, I can tell you, my childhood was spent partly in America and partly in Israel. And I never heard such anti-Haredi sentiments as I did at Israeli Shabbat tables, modern Orthodox Shabbat tables. I'm not talking about in the last year or two. I'm talking about all the time, especially when people have families have kids in the army. There was just this great resentment. So in answer to your question, I think part of it is that this is just coming at a time where there's so much raw emotion.
So you don't think there's any connection or possibility of alliance on these issues?
Alliance between...
Where the Haredi-Levi community will identify in the culture war with the Haredi anti-Zionist community?
It could be, you know... When the lines between these communities are fluid, just like in our shuls, there are the people who, you know, you go to a Haredi shul, you might have people who are full-on Haredim, and then you'll see there are people who, maybe they're wearing a black hat and a black suit, but they shave. And then, you know, you see some people like that in our shuls. It's a continuum. So I think it's a continuum in Israel, too. For example, if you go to the Yeshivat HaRav Kook in Jerusalem, some of those students do go to the army and some of them don't. You know, one of the things I didn't talk about, but which is a key element of this, is that the real Haredi, most of them don't live in the Shtachim. They don't live in the settlements because they don't want to be, especially the rabidly anti-Zionist ones, because they don't want to be associated in any way with the Zionist cause. So in some ways, that is the dividing line.
Okay, actually, I'm going to ask one other question. Sure. I think still one of the things that stays in my head was I had lunch with one of the, I think the second executive editor of the New Israel Fund many years ago. And he talked to me about how when he was a kid, one of the things he would do on Saturday night was take a bus into Mea Shearim to go beat up the Dasim. Mm-hmm. You know, there were street fights the other way too.
Right.
But he said they stayed away from the Belzers because the Belzers were tough. Yeah. But the other groups were easy prey. So I wonder, to what extent is it Haredi initiation of violence, or is there a long-standing cultural history of violence in which right now it happens that because of increasing numbers, so we get the episodes in which you have violence by Haredim get the publicity, but really this is just part of the Jets and the.
Right, the Jets and the Sharks.
The Jets and the Sharks going on for a long time. You know, once in a while, one side wins, and once in a while, the other side wins.
It could be. To be honest, I'm not familiar enough with the history of that to be able to answer your question adequately. But and I have not heard of cases of Chilonim beating up Haredim recently. And I would also say that out of the glare of the media. Things are often much better than they seem. A good friend of mine told me a story about when he was called up to the army, in reserves, during the Second Lebanon War. He got a call on Erev Shabbos, a few hours before Shabbos, and told to report to the Army Recruiting Center, which happened to be right near Kvish Bar Ilan. And he got there, and when he got there, they said, we have a transport to Lebanon, but it's not leaving for 3 hours. And apparently everybody else had been told, but he hadn't gotten the message, and he didn't have enough time to go home to his family in his neighborhood of Jerusalem, so he stayed there. And the Haredim invited him into the shul, into the local shul. He davened at their shul, and he was dressed in madim, in uniform, with his M16 on his shoulder. Nobody said anything. After davening was over, somebody came up to him and invited him to his home for dinner. He went, and when he left, he had to leave early. They benched early, and the Haredi insisted on walking him back to the place where he was supposed to meet the bus to go to Lebanon. And he said everybody was just behaving so nicely, and then the media came. And then the Haredi boys picked up their little rocks and started to throw them, Shabbos, Shabbos, Shabbos. So sometimes what happens in the media spotlight is very different from what happens when nobody's looking. And sometimes things are not as bad as they seem. Yeah.
2 points. There was another case in the Army where soldiers were protesting because they were going to have an instructor who was a woman. I think that's a very more dangerous thing. But the other thing was, in Beit Shemesh, I've been reading the reports, and they say the police do their job, they arrest them, but the courts let these people out. Can you comment on that?
Yeah. The Israeli justice system is not as strict as the American one. Plainly put, sentences are much lighter than they are here. In America, 2 or 3% of the population is incarcerated. That's more than that's a greater part of the more people who were incarcerated are incarcerated today in America than were incarcerated in the Gulag system in the Gulag archipelago. So Israel doesn't have that kind of system, and I think that crimes like these are treated in a different way than assaults that are not related to religious extremism or nationalist extremism. I don't know why that is, but you see the same thing with settler violence, where it's kind of a revolving door. But, you know, I'm not sure if this was somebody who was arrested and then released pending, trial. Or I don't think they see these people as a long-term threat to public safety, and they do go to trial or they do get sentenced, but they're not held in jail for the most part while they're waiting sentencing.
So following on that point, when you mentioned Miami Beach in Brooklyn, right? So obviously in the States people are going to follow laws and we have strict laws and there's discrimination and that's certainly an incentive for people to follow the law. I guess the question is there anything happening in Israel at a political level, strategic level, new conversations? Since so much of this is just compromise over 60 years in terms of never having a constitution, always working informally, is this going to perhaps provoke new conversations that there needs to be a definitive solution about who's a member of the state as a citizen or not, or we're just going to continue to raise?
Well, I don't think the issue is citizenship versus non-citizenship. Nobody's going to be stripped of their citizenship. But it certainly is a contributing factor in a growing conversation and a growing debate about what the obligations are of citizenship, that Haredim should not get an exemption from the army, but rather should perform some sort of national service and then be allowed to enter the workforce. There is constant talk about limiting the social welfare rights of Haredim beyond a certain number of children, say, to not provide aid once you've passed 8 kids or something like that. So there's always been this undercurrent of conversation in Israel, but I think that this most recent incident and other similar incidents have really brought it to the forefront, and there's much more serious debate. I mentioned the Tal law earlier. This is the law that grants exemptions from the army. And whereas it was renewed just a few years ago, now there's a very rigorous debate in the Knesset about whether or not to renew it, how to change it, and how to bring more Haredim into the workforce. So there is this growing movement, and I think you will see some change.
And do you think that's the source of where change will happen? That level?
Well, change has to happen on two levels, on the political level and on the civil society level. You know, On the one level, you want to make sure laws are in place to encourage people to behave in a certain way, whether that means entering the workforce or not being extreme. It's against the law in Israel to assault somebody physically. So it's not that these people, it's not that the law is not where it ought to be when it comes to these attacks. But then there's this civil society issue, which is getting communities to condemn violence and not condone it among their own members, getting people to learn how to treat each other with civility. This is something which is not just a problem in Beit Shemesh between Haredim and non-Haredim. It's a problem at the rental car counter at Ben Gurion Airport. You know?
Oh, yeah.
So, yes.
I think some of the issue is the fact that there is no separation of church and state in Israel, where you have, in fact, Haredi political parties that have power in the Knesset, and a party like Shas, you have to deal with them, make coalitions with them, so that there's an issue of actual political clout. Now, in a place like New York, the religious communities have political clout, but it's a very different type of political clout than actually being a part of the government.
Right. Right. No, that's an excellent point. You're absolutely right. Some of the debate surrounding the Tal law has been a factor in it. Nobody wants to anger the Haredi political party. Well, some people are willing to do so. But those who need them for the coalition are the prime minister, for example, is afraid of angering the Haredi political parties. And their power is growing. By the way, many of the Neturei Karta who are at the forefront of these protests in Beit Shemesh do not vote and do not want to be represented in the Israeli political system. They see that as a corruption of Judaism, and they will not participate. But the vast majority of Haredim do participate.
So, you know, along those lines, and what you referenced earlier in terms of the previous mayor in Beit Shemesh kind of playing different groups against each other, do you think that this in some way, shape, or form contributes to the macro-political level of certain political parties catering to certain minorities who, in their own interests, will cast kind of this wide net to come, all Haredi in this, all Haredi in that, because it plays to their demographic. Kind of, can you speak to that in terms of to what extent that might contribute to the problem?
Right. But, you know, in contrast to the American political system, in the American political system, your constituency is the people who live in your whatever it is, your district or your state. And in Israel, there is no there's no representative government. The Knesset is not made up of the mayors of the 120 districts. It's made up of these interests. And that's why people are aligned rather than with those who they live near. They're aligned with those who they have political leanings in common with. So you have the Shas constituency, and you have the Meretz constituency on the left. You have the Likud constituency, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that that contributes to it, and you see the reflection between, it happens in local politics, and it happens on the Knesset level, too.
So I guess, in following up, is a part of the solution, or is there any discussion surrounding to what extent that political system actually encourages certain forms of extremism?
Yes. Without a doubt, there is. Their political reform is seen as an urgent issue in Israel, and it's seen as an issue which is doomed to fail. Because how can you have... the Knesset will never vote to harm itself. You know what I mean? So the people who have the power, it's the people who don't have the power who want to have the power, and the people who have the power don't want to give it up. It's kind of like the difficulty in U.S. state governments. Most state governments in America, I think with the exception of just one or two states, have a bicameral legislature where there's a state Senate and a state House. Thank you. Do we really need both? It makes sense perhaps on the federal level where, the Senate is not representative, but the House is representative, but does it make sense on the local level, or is it just duplicating work? I think for the most part it doesn't make sense, but are you going to have any state Senate vote itself out of existence? Very difficult to do, and I think it's the same thing in Israel. Political reform is vital. People talk all the time about the necessity for representative government, but it's very hard to change a state, to change a form of government once you already have it going. Did you have a question? Yeah.
Could you maybe touch on how siege mentality, the part that plays in the extremism in general, as it does, I think, here in particular, and how it might be A, self-perpetuated, and B, in some ways, self-prophesied?
Haredim certainly do see themselves under siege. They see themselves as castigated by the non-Haredi media. There's always talk about the secular media and how they are portrayed in the media. And it's very difficult for them to step outside that. But also part of Haredi culture, and this is what separates Haredim from modern Orthodox, is Haredim believe in the wall, and having a wall between their community and the outside world. And that's what Haredi life is about. It's about protecting yourself from these outside influences, going beyond halacha to erect a wall of protection. And Chabad is probably the only Haredi sect that actively goes out and leaves those walls to try to bring people back into them. Some believe in it, but don't really do it. So I think that siege mentality is almost inevitable. And when they when you have separate communities, I think it's self-reinforcing, like you said, self-fulfilling. Yes.
How do you see the secular Jews and the modern Orthodox as bad? Isn't that the problem? They are actually betrayers of the Judaic faith?
Well, I think some of them see them as bad. Some of them see them as misguided. But again, it's unfair of me to stand here and talk about the Haredi community as a monolithic entity. There are many different kinds of Haredim. There are many Haredim who have non-Haredi family. So I don't think that they see them as bad. They might see them as beyond saving, so it's not worth their while. They're not really focused on that. I think they're more focused on themselves.
Recently, there was a mass demonstration, mostly I gather young people who feel the economic inequality in Israel is increasing. Is there a feeling on the part of younger people that the government's support for the Haredim is a drag on their own economic futures?
Absolutely.
And is there a political effect?
That's the $64,000 question. That last summer saw the biggest protest in Israel's history. And the protesters tried very hard not to make it about politics or religion. But it was about politics and religion. More religion than it was about politics. Because they didn't want to alienate potential constituents or fellow protesters, they didn't bring up the Haredi issue. But that was the undercurrent. And once the protests had subsided, there was more and more talk about how part of the problem of Israel's economic situation is that you have these Haredim who are a massive drag on the economy, and they have to be integrated into the workforce. The question is, when the next election comes around in a year and a half, or earlier, because this is Israel, will that translate into votes? Israelis have a very poor history of voting on anything other than security. At the end of the day, that's the single issue that they vote on. And with so much at stake now between Iran and Hezbollah and Hamas and all that, it's difficult it's difficult to predict this turning that into political power. It could happen. Who knows? Last week, there was a major strike in Israel by Israel's labor union, the Histadrut. Everything went on strike. And you have people from the left-leaning political parties who are trying to capitalize on the sentiment and win favor among among those social protesters, like Shelly Yachimovich of Labor and others. So we'll see. The jury's out. But would you give Shelly Yachimovich the keys to the F-16s when the question comes to decide what to do about Iran? You know, she's a TV broadcaster. I wouldn't trust a journalist with anything.
Is there an emergence of a Haredi middle class? And if so, are they being, you know, those who go to university and have decent paying jobs or living out of poverty? And if so, are they being shunned by the more right-wing extremist Haredi?
There is an emergence of a Haredi working class. I don't know if I would call it middle. I don't know exactly what middle class means. And in Israel, it's not the same as it is here. They're not shunned. They're not shunned. It's still considered preferable to be a kollel boy than to be a working boy. But they're not shunned. There's also something interesting which I learned when I was doing research for a story a few years ago that I had no idea about. That there are Haredim who believe in poverty as a virtue. That they don't want to get caught up in materialism and believe that it's better to be poor. not so poor as they are now, but poor. And, you know, I discovered this when I was doing a story about the Haredim who live in Modi'in Elite, another community midway between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. And there are a lot of companies in which that have bases in Modi'in Elite where they put Haredi women to work. The men still study in Shiva, but the women work. And they talked about how they don't want to be wealthy. They don't want to be comfortable, but they don't want to be as uncomfortable as they are. Yes. Well, tens of families, very small, very small.
And how are they related to these other groups, the Turei Karta?
Well, some of them are in the Turei Karta. They've taken these additional strictures on themselves. The ringleader has been this woman who started it all, who's now, I'm not sure if she's in prison or not, but she was arrested for beating her kids. No, but you had it right before he was shot.
Right.
You had people talking about, does Dean Rodef apply to him or not?
But as soon as it happened, I think the vast majority of rabbis, with very, very few exceptions, recognized that maybe we went too far criticizing him with such harsh language before. And I think the self-enforcement has got to be the only solution.
What did those rabbis say about Ariel Sharon after he pulled out of Gaza? They said he deserved the stroke that he got. So it only took them 10 years to forget. I'm saying memory is short.
I'm not trying to pray.
Right. Right, no, but all I'm saying is that... And by the way, it's a big turnoff. I mean, it is, and this is a matter for another time and for a PhD thesis or a book or what have you, but the rate of attrition in Israel's modern Orthodox community, I believe, is much higher than it is in America. That is to say that the number of kids from modern Orthodox families who cease to be religiously observant is much higher in Israel than it is here. Haredim, I don't know. I mean, it's certainly there. But, you know, it's a turnoff. It is a major turnoff. It is a turnoff to us. And we know that. And Matt, what is it like for our kids? How do you explain that to your kid? When you talk about, you know, what?
I say people aren't religious.
Right.
You never do that way. That keeping kosher is not the essence of the Torah.
Right.
Yeah. Right. But Israel is up there too.
Right. But you go into a yeshiva or a kollel and they're not studying Hilchos Avas Yisrael. You know, but you're absolutely right.
So, I mean, this is a question about kind of tens of families in terms of these sects. Can you speak for a moment about kind of the more mass rallies that, I don't know if that's also kind of just a larger sect or if this is something that is crossing Haredi sects that I don't know. I'm curious about the interplay there, where some of these issues seem also, you know, perhaps less extreme than you know what was going on in Beit Shemesh, but you know, the case of a husband who or a father, I should say, who killed the child and is now in custody, and this is bringing up a huge protest.
Mm-hmm. Again, that's. That's this siege mentality that the gentleman was talking about before. That it's not the Haredim as a whole. Again, it's really just these hooligans and these extremists who are looking for excuses to make trouble. But it's gotten to a point where they are able to portray any arrest of a Haredi or any intervention by the non-Haredi world in the Haredi world as an attack and as an unjustified attack, even when you have a case where somebody is abusing their kids and they're moving in to protect them. But I don't think it's fair to say that represents all Haredi. But, you know, the silent majority of Haredim don't get involved. They don't get involved.
But more speaking in terms of just the size of the rally.
Well, how big are the protests? They're not huge. But they're very visible.
Some of them are quite large.
Yeah,
I believe at least they received.
I mean, we're not talking about thousands of people. For what?
I think it was had to do with violence, something with the social
when world. They tried to arrest somebody.
I think that's what I recall from several years ago.
Yeah.
I'm curious, perhaps that was a perception or how the protest is portrayed. I was in the belief it was kind of in the thousands, and I didn't know if there were certain things that kind of cross various Haredi sects or if this was a large Haredi sect.
Well, I'm not sure which case you're referring to specifically. I mean, the protests range.
I think it was somewhere in
who beat his kid to death, right.
Yeah.
Right.
Is there anything that the specific incident that you began talking about is not, it's really about the women and how women are treated. And so I'm just wondering if there's any women within, non-Haredi or somebody, is there any outcry by any groups of women in Israel?
Absolutely. Yes, I'm glad you brought that up, and I'm sorry that I omitted that. Women's groups have responded in force to this thing from Hadassah, which is more of a women's organization in America. In Israel, it's more of a medical facility. But the New Israel Fund, which funds a lot of minority groups in Israel, including Arab groups, women's groups, responded very strongly. The Tzipi Livni, who is not just a leader of the Kadima Party, but a woman and sees herself as a feminist leader to some extent, although a lot of feminists have a problem with identifying her that way because they feel she hasn't done enough for the movement, was out at that protest. But a lot of it is about women. And, I was talking yesterday with Amy's brother, actually, Scott Kahn, Rabbi Scott Kahn, who lives in Beit Shemesh, who said, it's what do you have here? You have Haredim in their 20s, Haredi men, calling little girls prostitutes and worse. And what is it about? It's about sex and power. There's nothing clearer than that. It's about sex and power. And that's part of what this is. It's part of what this is. Remember, also, these people come from a community in which it's very regimented what they can and cannot do. There's a reason so many Haredim smoke. It's one of the few things they could do that's not kosher, but kosher. And this is an outlet for them. These are people who have anger and who have frustration. And there's a reason that it's targeted at women. And in this case, little girls, because there's sexual energy included in that. And there's anger toward women. And it's about women pushing women to the back of the bus. A lot of it has come out. A lot of the expressions of this extremism is directed toward women. And I think that's I'm very glad you brought it up. I'm sorry that I left it out. Yes.
One incident that gets listed among these problems is when the health ministry wanted these women doctors before, they wouldn't let her receive it.
Right. Unbelievable. I'll share with those who. I think so.
Is there a women's role going to be threatened?
I think that they are becoming more common. And let me just share for those who don't know, this is a woman who was given an award by the health ministry who wanted to come to the non-religious woman. And she wanted to collect her prize at the ceremony, and she decided she would be sensitive to the health minister, the deputy health minister, who happens to be Haredi. And so she wore a modest, so-called a modest dress, whatever it was, the long sleeves, etc. But apparently they didn't want a woman at all receiving the award in public, so they gave it to some man who then gave it to her husband. By the way, the health minister is Benjamin Netanyahu. There is no health minister.
I remember reading that was part of the problem is that some of the Haredi politicians don't want to officially be a minister, so they become the assistant minister.
Uh-huh.
But they really run the show from there.
Right, Could be. I mean, I from people I speak to who are involved in the healthcare field in Israel, it's more a dereliction of duty by the prime minister, not appointing somebody health minister. There have been other Haredi ministers. I'll take the last question. Yes.
I haven't read on the news anything about the reaction of the Haredi women to the Haredi.
Mm.
Did you hear anything?
Nothing. Nothing. Because somebody's still taking care of the kids. Somebody has to work. You know, that's what the women do. Haredi women are, I would say, seen but not heard, but they're not neither seen nor heard. That's not what a Haredi woman does. A Haredi woman supports the family. She's behind her man, behind her where you can't even see her. That's just, that's, you know. Right. She's a rare exception. Yeah.
They are the breadwinner and they have to work and they the guy that's having moving.
Right. Rav Avadya Yosef's daughter started a college to train Haredim and ready them for the workforce. I didn't hear anything from her. No, I didn't. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Maybe there are
no. Maybe tell us, sir, or should we fast track it?